Good morning, everyone. A bit of a heat wave. That's good, I guess. I just try to take advantage of the state of being. This week, I want to talk about a funny thing happened to me on the way to the Promised Land. Basically, and we're encountering this remarkable story of the first tourist to Israel. As you know the story, that tourists either come back enthralled or enraged, etc. So we have these first tourists, 12 Meraglim spies, and a lot of commentary about. Did Moses want to send the spies? Did God want to send the spies? Did the people want to send the spies? It doesn't matter. What matters ultimately is we get this pivot point, this inflection point in the story, which creates the idea that this generation that left Egypt will no longer be able to survive the trek of 40 years. So this is where it happens. It doesn't happen at the beginning of the story of Exodus that they're destined for 40 years. Matter of fact, the beginning of Bamidbar a few weeks back, we talked about the census and the counting of people, military age, etc. So they were ready to go up for the conquest. And then this little story comes in. It's an interesting story. And what I like about the story is that it's so remarkably resembles our own state of being all the time. Between having facts, quote unquote, having information, quote unquote, and coming up with totally different interpretations of the same information, which is kind of interesting, right? So even facts don't help much when you have in your own mind how you want to interpret them. And this, of course, is the great challenge of what we call today intelligence gathering, etc. So Moshe, basically, in our parsha, called Shelach Lecha, send. And then, of course, it has that little word, Shelach Lecha, which we had earlier on in Lech Lecha, which can be understood, go to yourself, or Shelach Lecha, send to yourself. It's very complicated. But he says, basically, here are the four questions. Here are some questions I want to ask you. And this is what you have to go out and find out for me. And also, this is a way to sort of encourage the people that what we're doing right now is really going to be successful, etc., etc. So he's hoping that that these spies will come back answering these questions. And the first question was, what kind of a country is it? How many are there people who dwell in the country? Are they weak? Are they strong? Is the land itself a good land, a bad land? Are the towns open or fortified? Is the soil rich or pure? Is it wooded or barren? Bring back a sample of the fruit of the land. And it was at that point the season, it was mentioned in the text, the season of the first grapes. Well, they all come back with basically the same information. And of course, the interpretation is very different. And 10 of them come back demoralized, that it would be impossible to take over this land. The land is heavily fortified, the people are giants. They're so big, we look as if we are grasshoppers in their eyes. Basically, everything is fertile, but it's a very dangerous place to be. And of course, the answers are can be understood in many different ways. If a country, for instance, if the land is fortified, well, it means the people are scared. They have to build forts. So if they lived outdoors on the plain, they'd be more dangerous because they were less fearful. And it goes on and on and on. So they have the same information. Two come back encouraged, and 10 come back demoralized. But more importantly, this is like an added straw to the back of Moshe and Aaron, who in the last parshas have been dealing with this grumbling and murmuring of the people. And this is like another, if you will, this is the straw that breaks the camel's back. The results are that this generation would die off. Now, what is it that really is going on here? Well, again, as I said, the minute you go into a non-historical mode or a non-narrative mode and understand what's going on here a little bit below the surface, we begin to see a number of things. One of the most persistent commentaries that I've found, many different ways saying the same thing, that this was done, the Ten come back with this report because they didn't want to go into the land, and it was a desire to avoid the physical world. They were living in this rather, even though it was a wilderness, rather idyllic. They were getting, you know, manna from heaven. They were in direct contact with Moses. They saw the Mishkan, the tabernacle. They saw the cloud of God, the fire of the cloud. It's very, very immediate connection, if you will, to the miraculous realm of the spirit. And they didn't want to go into the physical world. The spies preferred the effortless, if you will, spirituality of the Midbar, and dreaded the work of having to take the physical earthly world, the world that they're going to have to go into and work in and become, if you will, farmers, and etc. They knew that it's easier to live in the effortlessly spirituality of the desert than trying to spiritualize their physical lives. And this is seen by many of the commentators in mystical tradition and Hasidic tradition as the fundamental spiritual failure. Whereas most of the tradition believes, at least in the mystical tradition, as you know, based upon many sources, particularly Rabbi Isaac Luria, the quest for the divine is not found outside of the physical world. On the contrary, it's entering into physicality, lifting up what is called in the Lurianic language, the sparks that have been shattered and spread through the world. And that really is where we begin the process of redemption, is by basically going into the world. So that's one thing that is talked about when it tries to understand why these 10 people would come back. They're all leaders of their tribes. They're people with, you know, tremendous acts of courage, etc. They can't understand it. So this is one of the reasons they give. They really didn't want to get involved in a real world. In a real world. They wanted to, I don't want to get political, they wanted to be in diaspora. They didn't want to make aliyah. They want to be in diaspora. Another possible thing is they say this very famous line in this parsha, which says, we were like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and so we were in their eyes. Interesting projection, right? There's a trap of self-perception, and many of the teachings emphasize that they indeed, it's okay to feel small. You know, you say, oh, I'm just like a grasshopper. But they were punished, if you will, for projecting their own insecurities onto the Canaanites. And this is seen, again, as an act of a lack of faith and not understanding that sometimes God contracts. Another mystical word uses simtzum. God contracts, and the protective grace comes back, and it relies on our own flawed, ego-driven human calculations. Another bizarre one—not bizarre, but an interesting commentary—sees the. This is again from Rabbi Isaac Luria, the Arizal, he's called. This story is a cosmic correction or rectification of the story of Joseph and his brothers. So, according to the Rabbi Isaac Luria, the souls of the 10 spies were a reincarnation of the 10 brothers who sold Joseph into slavery. In both instances, here and as in the story of Joseph, they broke apart this sense of unity, and they slandered something that was destined to be a foundation of the Jewish nation. And their punishment in the wilderness was seen as a tikkun, if you will, for that rejection of Joseph back in the book of Genesis. So there's a lot to say, and we can talk more about it, but I just wanted to just talk about one thing that I found to be very, very important, is the fact that, well, what does it mean when it says they met giants? It's an interesting thing. Are we talking about giants in the fairy tale sense, you know, the ones that Jack went up to find on the beanstalk. Or, as one commentator says it beautifully, it mentions that in Hebron, where one of the spies visits, that there was a stronghold of three giants. Now, these giants can be understood in mythic, in the mythic sense, like the Titans in Greek mythology, Titans. And they have names, I won't get bothered with the names, but they basically are representative of the three giants of what's a good word, arrogance and ego. And basically what we're up against is we're against these gargantuan, gigantic force which ego is. And there are a number of ways of dealing with it, obviously. One of them is to submit to it, you know, and live that way with your ego as your driving force. Or you can basically see how much of this ego issue is really something to be curtailed and to be kept in kept in lockstep with other desires that you have. So the ego is not necessarily a negative thing, but it's something that has to be kept in check all the time. What else can we talk about the story? Well, there's a lot to say, but more importantly, what I'd like to, you know, just get across from what I've been thinking all week is, do we really want to know a lot about what's going to be coming up in our lives? I mean, how do we send our own spies into the future? Well, it's hard to do, obviously, because we only live in the now, but I do think that we have a part of ourselves that really likes to project so much into the future about ourselves. And sometimes we call that a self-fulfilling prophecy because we sometimes basically can conjure up all kinds of issues, all kinds of disasters in the future. You know, it's possible to catastrophize so much. And another way, though, is, however, to develop a clearer sense of what is ahead. And the only way I know what that clear sense of what is ahead is how I am relating to myself and how I understand my own role, my own position, what are my goals, what are my aspirations, etc. How do I want to get from here to there? And we often conjure up in our minds all kinds of ways, all kinds of pathways of getting from here to there. And some of them are confounded by our ego, taking on maybe more than we can chew, or confounded by our inability, because of our ego, to take in advice from others, causing perhaps some calamity. But more importantly, we basically have this desire, in desire, that things should go the way we want them to go, obviously. But that's such a very small little kernel of desire. Because how I want it to go in any particular time of my life is not what all the other myriads and myriads and myriads and billions of people are necessarily wanting to go in their direction. So obviously the articulation of my need is important, and achieving my goals are quote unquote important for me, but it doesn't fit into maybe a larger picture of the goals of millions and millions of others. Thus, you can feel bound by that, you can feel restricted by that, and on the other hand, it does open you up, at least it suggests to me that you should open up yourself to realize that there is perhaps something more than my individual needs and goals, and there is something in a larger collective. And I think that's what helped create religion in general, was people finding, if you will, this idea of a common collective thinking about going into the future. How do we get together? I was listening to this wonderful writer, Dara Horn, who talks about one of the real issues that we have lost in our own Jewish identity is that we're not a religion, that we're not a race, we are a people. And we have joined a people because of a desire to achieve similar goals. And we know we can do that more in the collective rather than in the individual. One other little side note that I picked up. Many people have asked me over the years, why do you need 10 people to make a minyan? Why 10? And it's interesting enough that one of the sources for the 10 is this parsha as well, because God, who is now frustrated with the 10 spies, says, what should we do with this evil congregation? So the word Eidah, Ra'ah, this evil congregation, the word Eidah also means a community. So the minimum you need to have for a community is 10. And thus we got the idea of 10 people for a minyan. The frustration of God, as we read last week, was quite severe. And this, of course, is really just basically the end point. This generation who left Egypt basically doesn't really want to engage, according to the mystical tradition, who wants to avoid the engagement with the real world. And thus, they were not able, or they were not equipped to take on the challenges of entering into the land. And thus, 40 years will pass, and it will be a time when, by the time of the end, only their children will have that opportunity. The children who had not been slaves and had grown up in this new sense of community that was created after the Exodus. So we can throw it open for some discussion. I'd love to hear more about it. But just always bear in mind that this seems to be a major breaking point, a major inflection point to slaves in this entire story of the wilderness. And next week, I don't want to give you too much, but next week someone's going to take advantage of this demoralized state. A cousin of Moshe called Korach, and you say, wow, boy, Moshe and Aaron, they're really down now, boy, oh, what a chance, and he tries to usurp, and that leads to another fascinating story, which I'll leave for the weeks to come, but this is the thing, you know, how much of us, how much do we give up for the collective, how much of our own aspirations can be fulfilled without the collective? I don't think many of them can, to be honest. I think that the way we aspire to things personally has to be within a collective, has to be within like-minded people with like-minded desires, like-minded, if you will, capacity for sacrifice, like-minded people who are willing to enter into covenantal relationship with each other as well as with the divine. So good to see you all. So I hope I've confused you as much as I've been confused, and then I know we've reached a new stage of wisdom.